Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is part two of today's clinical focus, examining the relationship between nutrition and sleep. Poor diet, it turns out, is tied to inflammation. All right? Now, studies have shown, and I'm going to quote one here from the journal Circulation, November 2010, sleep quality and duration are associated with higher levels of inflammatory biomarkers. Now, the key word is associated. Does sleep cause inflammation? Or does inflammation, does lack of sleep cause inflammation? Or does inflammation cause insomnia or lack of sleep? And the answer is, it's a chicken and egg situation. One of the ways that we can help visualize this is think of the type of sleep that you had the last time you had the flu. One of the things that occurs when you have the flu is you get a tremendous outpouring of cytokines, different substances like interleukin. And that's one of the reasons why you feel so achy and you feel so tired. And you also feel depressed because this type of inflammation profoundly affects the brain. But think of your quality of sleep. You're sleeping like maybe 18 hours, but you feel exhausted because the sleep is not restorative. It's almost like sort of a nightmarish quality of light sleep. And that is what some individuals experience all the time because their bodies are flooded with inflammatory cytokines. So that is a factor. So what does that mean in terms of diet? Well, there is such a thing as a pro-inflammatory diet and an anti-inflammatory diet. We know that certain foods are inflammatory, or they lead to the production of inflammatory substances in the body. These foods are bereft of natural anti-inflammatory substances, and they have pro-inflammatory substances like harmful fats, lots of omega-6 fats, poor quality vegetable oils, lots of sugar. These are foods that we can consider pro-inflammatory. Foods that are anti-inflammatory, fruits, vegetables, spices, like turmeric is a wonderful anti-inflammatory spice, but many other spices have anti-inflammatory effects. Chocolate, red wine, although chocolate's got certain substances that may be bioactive and stimulating, but cocoa, polyphenols that you find in berries and in fresh fruits and vegetables. Also, the omega-3 fatty acids, we'll talk a little bit more about them, that you find in fish. These have anti-inflammatory effects. So we can, sleep deprivation causes inflammation, but we can attenuate that inflammation by going on a less inflammatory diet. All right, you sometimes see ads and articles like X number of foods to help you sleep better. What are the foods? Do almonds make you sleep better? Or does a warm glass of milk before bed make you sleep better? Let's examine the claims. Let's first look at what are sleep robbers. There's no question that there are sleep robbers. Caffeine, notorious for causing sleep problems. We'll look at it a little more in depth. Alcohol cuts both ways because it can be somewhat helpful for some people sometimes, but also usually net effect of large amounts of alcohol negative on sleep. Excitotoxins, what are those? We'll talk about that. Tyramine and food intolerances. These are some of the issues we'll touch upon as sleep robbers. Okay, let's look at studies on caffeine. Caffeine effects on sleep taken 0, 3, or 6 hours before bed. Because the $64,000 question for consumers of caffeine is, if you're having sleep problems, should you completely stop or should you just time your caffeine? I think pretty much people have sleep problems. Some people can take caffeine right before bed and they sleep fine. Other people, they have to cut off caffeine at a certain point. So here's what one study showed. 400 milligrams of caffeine, that's like a potent Starbucks coffee, was administered either 0, 3, and 6 hours before going to bed. Results demonstrated a moderate dose of caffeine had effects on sleep at all three times of administration. So the study suggests that caffeine taken even 6 hours before bed has important disruptive effects on sleep. And that makes us think that we should tell people to refrain from substantial caffeine use for a minimum of 6 hours before bedtime. And it varies from person to person. Some, you know, we now know that some people are rapid metabolizers of caffeine. Other people are slow metabolizers of caffeine. People have different tolerances. And other people simply have greater, you know, more robust sleep that's not interfered with caffeine. What about alcohol? 30% of people with persistent insomnia report using alcohol to help them sleep in the past year. That's a pretty high percentage. That's nearly one third. And 67% of them, two thirds, report alcohol was effective in inducing sleep. So that, you know, the nightcap is highly relied upon by a lot of people with sleep problems. And a lot of people rate it highly. The ones that people use alcohol to help them sleep with a nightcap say it works. It's pretty effective. However, it's been shown that alcohol may inhibit REM sleep. They did a meta-analysis of 27 studies, and they show that alcohol does not improve sleep quality, and I think that's pretty obvious. Alcohol may decrease sleep latency. In other words, sleep latency is just a fancy word, which means the time it takes to fall asleep. But you get rebound hyperexcitation, which is associated with wakefulness. And in studies show that in healthy people, acute high doses of alcohol actually disturb sleep. But it might be conceded that in insomniacs, lower doses may be beneficial. So, you know, most people involved in sleep work tell people absolutely stay away from alcohol, but actually a practical solution for some insomniacs is a little bit of a drink at night. But it's a razor's edge between what's effective and what ultimately undermines sleep and leaves people groggy and hungover. Okay, another class of chemicals that can adversely affect sleep are the excitotoxins, and we owe a debt of gratitude to Russell Blaylock, who did the pioneering work on this. Excitotoxins are substances that are artificial that are added to food. They include aspartame or NutraSweet, MSG, which appears under a wide gamut of weasel words in terms of labeling, natural flavors, hydrolyzed protein, yeast extract. These are many euphemisms for MSG. And then again, there are other things that may have an excitotoxic effect. You know, some of the bizarre chemicals and food colorings that are used for flavor and appearance in candies and in many processed foods. These may have excitotoxic effects, direct brain stimulatory effects, and they're there for a reason, is they light up your brain, and they really have the potential to stoke people's appetite and sell a lot of junk food. But these excitotoxins may overstimulate the neurons of the brain, causing sleep disturbances. One interesting... this is a little bit of an oddball sidebar, but in Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, the whole story of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol is that it's thought to be a nightmare. Is that Scrooge? Mr. Scrooge, when he sees all these apparitions, he thinks he's having a nightmare at first. And, you know, it's not literally stated, but he's having this vision. Is it real? Is it not real? And there's a quote from the Christmas Carol. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of underdone potato. There is more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are. This is Scrooge talking to his apparitions. And this is a suggestion that there are foods that can give you disturbed sleep. And cheese is a representative among them. Cheese is a substance that's rich in tyramine. And tyramine actually triggers what are called adrenergic effects. In other words, it sets off adrenaline in the brain, and this could impact dreaming. It could cause your dreams to be weird or hallucinogenic or nightmarish. But if you're a poor sleeper, you could also get an effect on sleep disruption due to tyramine in food. So tyramine is also present in other foods. It's present in aged meats. Some people actually have tyramine sensitivity, and these types of foods are contraindicated if you're on a less frequently used type of antidepressant called MAO inhibitors. All right, food intolerances. Well, what if you have a food intolerance? And I use the word intolerance deliberately, and it's not allergy, because typically conventional allergy defines a food allergy as, you sneeze, you wheeze, or you start choking, you develop anaphylaxis. These are true allergies, but what happens when you eat certain foods that affect you through other pathways is you may have restlessness, you may have nasal congestion, you may have reflux, bodily aches and pains, asthma. These all can contribute to sleep problems. And the ways you detect them, well, you can detect them through traditional allergy tests like the IgE-RAST or skin tests, or we use the IgG-RAST. You can do serologic testing, obviously, for gluten sensitivity, celiac disease, or one of the best ways is you can say, hey, there's potential for certain foods to cause problems. Let's do a trial of elimination. Typical culprits are gluten, wheat, dairy, corn, and yeast. But other foods can cause symptoms. And I got to say that sometimes when people have sleep problems and they get off one or another food, their rest really improves, because reactions to foods trigger cytokine responses and sometimes nervous system responses, and you get pretty uncomfortable. Okay, what are the best foods for sleep? Well, one of the questions is, when you have going to Thanksgiving dinner and you feel like you're conking out, what is it? Is it the turkey or the dessert that does it? Turkey is high in tryptophan, which is a precursor for serotonin. And serotonin is generally thought to be associated with relaxation. And tryptophan is also a precursor for melatonin. So it's not, well, you eat a lot of turkey and you fall asleep. But actually, part of it may be that you're having a high-carb meal, and the high carbs may affect your serotonin, because carbohydrates facilitate the ingress of tryptophan across the blood-brain barrier, where it then becomes a substrate for serotonin synthesis. So actually, one way of getting serotonin made is to take a lot of tryptophan. Another is to take the carbs, which facilitate the uptake of tryptophan. So it's a, which is it, the turkey or the pumpkin pie? Not clear. There was an author of a book, Dr. Wertman, who wrote a book entitled Potatoes Not Prozac. And high glycemic index carbs have the ability to increase the ratio of circulating tryptophan to long-chain amino acids via the action of insulin. And that promotes a muscle uptake of these long-chain amino acids. And then there's less of them to compete for CNS uptake. So they did an experiment with this in terms of, what type of meal is most conducive to sleep. And they compared a low glycemic index rice meal to a high glycemic index rice meal in 20 healthy male subjects. And what they found is that the high glycemic index meal was more successful after when given 4 hours prior to bedtime than a low glycemic index meal. Let me explain that again. The high glycemic index meal that released the carbohydrates faster than the low glycemic index meal was better, and the time of administration, the optimal time of administration, is 4 hours prior to bedtime versus 1 hour prior. So no human studies have actually supported the dietary tryptophan for sleep, but some animal studies have shown that alpha-lactalbumin, which is rich in tryptophan, by the way, that's a constituent of whey protein, that it can promote slow-wave sleep. I will tell you this, is there may be something to this thing about taking some carbs before bedtime, because I have experienced putting patients on very low-carb diets, and some very low-carb diets often report disturbed sleep patterns, at least at first after they get used to it. So eating a diet to put you into like a ketogenic diet, restlessness is one of the symptoms, and sometimes mood disorders and depression and anxiety, because carbs have a calmative effect via their ability to stimulate serotonin production. So here's the paradox. I call it the milk and cookies bedtime snack paradox. You know, what is, you know, if you have like a sweet dessert, it may facilitate serotonin production in your brain, but what goes against it is that it may exacerbate hypoglycemia. And if you have too much of those sweets and you get heavy and you become more insulin resistant, that is going to subvert your sleep. So I call that the milk and cookies bedtime snack paradox. There's also what is called a postprandial effect. Whatever you eat a big honking meal, like most people eat at Thanksgiving, high volume, high fat, high glycemic index meals trigger a autonomic nervous system response in the gut, which increases parasympathetic tone, which confers relaxation. That's why a lot of people eat when they're nervous to relax, because when you eat a big meal, it chills out your sympathetic nervous system. In order to digest foods and secrete digestive juices, saliva, and pancreatic enzymes, you need to go parasympathetic. And so you can if you don't know how to relax and meditate, food will do it to you. It'll put you into a lethargic, torpid, relaxed, parasympathetic state. And that's why a lot of people with a big meal, they conk out. They get down on the sofa, and they are gonzo, because there's simply a postprandial effect of a big meal, which if you're contemplating a long car drive, that may not, or, you know, you're a pilot of a plane, that may not be such a great idea. But if you want to get to sleep, all right. Dietary melatonin. There are several studies indicating dietary influence on the synthesis or concentration of melatonin. Actually, what's interesting is that if you fast, it will limit your melatonin production. So fasting can, in fact, make you more alert. And some foods, especially edible plants, contain melatonin. Tomatoes, wine, coffee, surprisingly, actually contains melatonin and its precursor tryptophan. Milk is definitely, you know, that's why they say dairy product. Interestingly, milk that is produced at night is richer in melatonin than milk produced early in the day. That's from, like, you're drinking mother's milk. The milk that you produce in the morning is wake-up milk, and the milk that you produce at night is nighty-night milk that has more melatonin in it. It's interesting. And that maybe may argue for women to nurse at night while not looking at their smartphones or in darker light, because you produce more melatonin in the absence of light, and your baby will sleep better. Or maybe if you have a cow, milk your cow at night and drink the milk. In a dark barn, of course. In general, diets rich in vegetables, fruits, and grains contain significant levels of dietary melatonin. Alcohol will antagonize melatonin production, as does cortisol, hence the effects of prednisone, and hence the effects of stress. Iron. Iron's, we'll go into a few specific nutrients in terms of their effects on sleep. If you're iron deficient, you're more likely to have restless leg syndrome. But not just the adult form. It turns out that 6 to 18-month-old infants with iron deficiency anemia had reduced sleep duration and increased night waking. Iron supplementation has been shown to improve restless leg syndrome. And in a study of autistic children with restless sleep, iron therapy significantly ameliorated their sleep problems. This is in autism. Iron is vital to dopamine, which plays a role in the neural network supportive of sleep. And the target, if you're attempting to improve sleep in someone with a low iron, is a ferritin greater than 50. That I have found to be a target, because many, especially women, are walking around with a ferritin that's, you know, 15, 20, 30, and that's thought to be, well, that's okay, that's adequate. But in order to optimize sleep, you may have to go higher. Magnesium. Magnesium may also be helpful for patients with restless leg syndrome or periodic leg movement sleep. Taking magnesium along with melatonin and zinc in one study ameliorated insomnia in nursing home residents. And magnesium has been known to augment sedation under anesthesia, so you get deeper sedation if you take magnesium. Magnesium deficiency results in exaggerated sympathetic tone, which means sort of an adrenalized state or a nervous state. And correspondingly, norepinephrine or adrenaline causes magnesium to be peed out of your body. Your kidneys eliminate more magnesium. So it's a vicious cycle. You're more magnesium deficient, you'll be more nervous. You're more nervous, you'll cause more magnesium to go out. So you can actually get into a vicious cycle of hypomagnesemia if you're stressed. Insomnia is a feature of clinical hypomagnesemia. You know, you go through all the symptoms, you know, excess reflexes, and there's cardiac abnormalities. But actually, insomnia is one of the documented features of clinical low magnesium. What causes it? Diarrhea, stress. Alcohol will deplete magnesium in high amounts. Diuretics certainly deplete magnesium. Steroids. And commonly used proton pump inhibitor medications. They actually have a black box warning that show that they deplete magnesium. This would be Nexium and Protonix and Prevacid and that whole raft of medications. Omega-3 fatty acids, you know, we talked about inflammation, the pro-inflammatory diet versus the anti-inflammatory diet. Your omega-3 to 6 ratio, the relative amount of omega-3s to omega-6s that can be determined in your red blood cell membranes is an important determinant of your risk of inflammation. And EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid, DHA from docosahexaenoic acid, impact cytokines. They actually impact the production of cytokines that are responsible for inflammation. We also know that supplementation with DHA improves autonomic tone. What does that mean? It actually may slow down sympathetic and bolster parasympathetic, which has a relaxing effect. Babies born to mothers who have, this is a study, babies born to mothers who have DHA that was greater than the median had more mature sleep-wake cycles than those born to mothers with DHA less than the median. So the maternal DHA impacts kids, and higher blood levels of DHA correlated with better sleep quality in school-age children. Red blood cell, that's actually, I have to say, as an aside, I had terrible adolescent insomnia or pre-adolescent insomnia, and I probably had a severe essential fatty acid deficiency because I was very finicky. I consumed no fish, and that, you know, may have been part of it. Red blood cell DHA, but not fish consumption or supplement use, has been found to correlate with severity of obstructive sleep apnea. So it's a correlation. They weren't able to show that eating more fish or taking omega-3 supplements improved obstructive sleep apnea. There was the additional benefit of the attenuation of the cardiovascular risk in these patients, because obstructive sleep apnea patients have three times the cardiovascular risk. And one half of patients with coronary artery disease turns out to have obstructive sleep apnea. So it's an epidemic among patients with coronary artery disease. So many patients are obese. So, you know, fish oil is not going to hurt and will help the cardiovascular profile of those people. However, there are no controlled trials of omega-3 administration for sleep disorders. There's some studies that suggest that antioxidants may be missing in patients with obstructive sleep apnea because it's associated with oxidative stress, endothelial dysfunction, and, of course, increased cardiovascular risk. Vitamin C is a major free radical scavenger, and so they actually did a study showing that intravenous vitamin C in patients with obstructive sleep apnea helped improve arterial circulation, but only in patients with obstructive sleep apnea. For patients who don't have sleep apnea, it didn't make a difference, probably because they didn't need it. So they conclude in the study, antioxidant strategies should be explored for the treatment of obstructive sleep apnea-related cardiovascular disease. Nitric oxide. I'd like to talk about nitric oxide because it's a signaling molecule that is ubiquitous throughout the body, responsible for many things. It's responsible for maintaining the tone of your blood vessels. It's responsible for erections. It turns out that obstructive sleep apnea is associated with decreased levels of circulating nitric oxide. And when you do CPAP, which is the corrective treatment for obstructive sleep apnea, it actually augments nitric oxide and L-arginine levels. And the question is whether L-arginine supplements or dietary nitrates and nitrites could be helpful for patients with obstructive sleep apnea, and maybe it will support their cardiovascular health. A major dietary source of nitrites is beets. So there's a variety of ways in some that diet have an impact on sleep, and sleep in turn has a major impact on diet because, and this is part of the problem, is that I think one of the ways to attack the problem of obesity and insulin resistance and cardiovascular disease in this country is to address sleep, but you have to address sleep also from the standpoint of the right type of nutrition to optimize sleep. Thank you very much, and I hope that you maintain wakefulness throughout this podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.